So today I continue the discussion on the presentation of the non-abelian gauge series, and now we have on firm ground to discuss some issues about the renormalization and the physics of gauge series. And tomorrow I hope to be able to introduce you to the Higgs mechanism. Okay, so gauge series. So we took the example of the group G equals SU2 for simplicity. But we have seen that in order to quantize the theory in a consistent way by functional integral, we need to, of course, to have a gauge fixing. And this simplest way, or a very neat way to treat gauge fixing in a mathematical way is to introduce additional field, which are the ghost field, which takes into account, which represents the Fadeyev-Popov determinants, which is a proper measure you have to integrate over the field once you have gauge fixed. So gauge fixing. And I'm going to use usually the Landau gauge. So I have the gauge field, which is mu A of x, where A goes from 1 to 3, but that's basically the indices of the adjoint representation of the group G, and the mu are the Lorentz indices. Okay, and we have to introduce ghost field C of A x and C bar, which is C bar A of x, with A the same indices, which belong to the adjoint representation. And if we use the Lorentz gauge, but the formulation general, namely B mu A mu equals 0, then the action we need to use, S is the function of A, C, and C bar, is the standard Young-Mills action. So S Young-Mills for A plus an action for gauge fixing, depend on A, and eventually of an auxiliary field, and an action for the ghosts, which depend on A, on C, and C bar. Okay. And is there, you have a question? No. Okay. And the gauge, the Young-Mills action is a standard one. So this is integral d4x trace of f mu mu f mu mu with a factor 1 over 4 g squared, I think, and maybe a minus sign. I have to be careful about the normalization. Well, that's the standard generalization of the, well, I won't find the right formula. It's not very important at that stage. The gauge fixing condition will be at that stage, either something like integral d4x lambda a d mu a mu for the Lorentz gauge. So lambda, remember, is a Lagrange multiplier. It's an auxiliary field, which is just there to enforce, when you integrate over it in the exponential of the action, to enforce this condition. And in fact, there is a slightly different gauge which is convenient for calculation, which was introduced by Feynman, where you replace this term by, you have no lambda,
But you replace this basically by a factor which is of order 1 over some mass scale that I'm going to set, a parameter, that's a parameter chi and psi, and this is going to be just d mu a mu squared. And there is a factor 2, I think. And okay, so I won't detail how you go from this to this, but it's a variant of this. Because you see, when you have an exponential, this parameter goes to infinity. You see, you have a Gaussian, but if this goes to infinity, d mu a mu must be zero, because it's the exponential of this to the square. The maximum, it's very peaked around this equals zero, so the limit. So goes to zero is this parameter. Okay. And finally, what's important is the ghost action, which is integral d4x, and written in a, you can write it in different ways, but you can write this as d mu c bar d mu c, where d mu is the ordinary derivative. And the covariant derivative acting on a field in the adjoint representation, adjoint something, is d mu of adjoint something plus or minus, I never remember. That's the notes. Should know this by heart. Chup, 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 chup. I'm going to write the commutator of mu with the adjoint field. So let's call it psi. Right. Is there an I or? I don't remember, and I can't find the page where this is written.
Minus I.
It's minus I, yes. Okay. And for a field in the fundamental representation, this is d mu of psi in the fundamental representation minus a mu times psi in the fundamental. Okay, so the C's belong to the adjoint representation, so this d mu contains a commutator between a mu and c. Okay. This is the covariant derivative. And finally, if you have matter field, you replace d mu by d mu as in Maxwell's theory. Okay. And so, yesterday at the end of the lecture, I see that the Young-Mills action now with this action contains two things. So first, in order to construct perturbation theory, you consider that G is small, so you rescale A into GA. It's just a chain of variable, so that the non-linear term in the Young-Mills action becomes of order g and g squared, And finally, and this term d mu, which acts on C, is over G. So the term of interaction between the ghost and A mu is over G. So that's the standard things. So finally, I'm going to write things in a very sketchy way. You find that the propagator for the gauge field I represent as in quantum electrodynamics is written explicitly, but epsilon times h mu nu plus psi minus 1 times k mu divided by k squared. If you have a momentum k, that's with using the Landau, the Feynman gauge and the Feynman gauge. In fact, there is a 1 over 2 psi for the normalization, but that's a detail. And h mu nu is just minus 1 plus metric. Okay, so this is the propagator, in fact, of the photon in Maxwell's theory. You can play this game in Maxwell's theory. You just have a delta AB, which means that the gauge indices are conserved. The propagator for the, well, let's write it like that. Since it's a ghost, it's somehow, so if you have a momentum K for the ghost that goes from C, so it carries an index A and an index B, and it corresponds to C going to C bar, so there's a flow on it. Yes? The propagator is minus I delta AB divided by K squared minus I epsilon plus. So it's a propagator of a boson, because the C is a boson. It's not a fermion, but it's oriented. It has an orientation of a fermion, because this goes from C to C bar, as the propagator for the fermion in QED goes from psi to psi bar. Okay. And that's it. And for the propagator, and now you have interaction vertices. So you have the interaction vertices that comes from the gauge fields that we have discussed, I think, 2 lectures ago. So you have this, which is a term that comes from DAA term. You have the, this, which comes from an AAA term. And of course, you have to remember that this carries indices B nu C rho. And there is a derivative. So this is going to depend on the momenta. So this is going to depend on the momenta K P Q carried by the incoming gauge field, gauge particle. So this will be linear in the K, in the momenta. Here, it's just going to be order 1, but there will be a tensor product between the mu, B mu, C rho, and D, I don't know, sigma. So it will be, it doesn't depend on K. On the momenta. But it carries a complicated Lorentz index structure, which describes how the spin, the polarization of the gauge field are exchanged during this process of collision process. So, but there are okay. So I'm not going to right there, because I'm not going to do some explicit calculation, but you can find them in the notes, and you can find them, of course, also in the books. Yes?
Why don't the actions for gauge fixing and ghosts have trace?
Pardon?
Why isn't there a trace in the action for ghosts and gauge fixing?
Because gauge fixing is gauge fixing. Gauge fixing is a constraint you enforce on the functional integral. And the ghost term represents the change in the measure once you have enforced this fixing. So remember the logic we had on Tuesday. We introduced this delta constraint enforcing the gauge, and then we saw what was the determinant, the measure term associated to that. So we had to compute the determinant of some operator depending on A. But the gauge fixing do not depend on C, because you introduce C afterwards. So maybe there are some formalism you can make things more complicated, but we don't need that. Okay. Okay, and finally, of course, since the ghost term contains a coupling between A and C, we have an interaction vertex between a gauge field and a ghost field. So the gauge field contains let's say that this is A, this is B, and this is C, and this is going to contain it will be linear in the momenta, let's say in the momentum of the incoming, for instance, C here. It carry and the coupling between, so, and it will be in K, so you will have a momentum, incoming momentum here, for instance, and the vertex will be proportional to K mu, because you have one momenta, it has to be linear in the momenta, and you have only one index here, which means it reflects the fact that you have a d mu a mu in the, when you compute, okay? And that's it. And of course, this is over the G. This is over the G squared. And this is over the G. So this is the term which contains DC C bar A. And it's linear in G. So now, so this has a rule, the Feynman rules. And from this, we can start to discuss, construct perturbation theory. So you construct radiative corrections. On diagrams, etc., according to the standard law. And in particular, we can start to discuss what is the renormalization properties of the theory. And well, all this formalism has been developed by physicists in the 60s and the beginning of the 70s, because they knew that there was a serious problem with the renormalization, or even the renormalizability of gauge theories. For a long time, people lots of physicists were suspicious about the gauge theories, because they said, oh, but they cannot be renormalized, there is a problem, which was finally solved here. And you can see that you naively expect that the theory is renormalizable, because in four dimensions, if you think about this, you see A mu must have a dimension
The gauge field must have the dimension of a length in power 1. Because it's only with this condition that f mu nu, which contains derivative of A and commutators of A, has dimension no, I'm saying something stupid. This is length minus 1. That's length minus 2. See. So this must be general. And it's only in 4 dimensions that you have a length to the power square times f mu nu, which ensures that the coupling constant has a dimension of a length to the power 0. So it's dimensionless. And as for phi 4, or as for the other theory we have been considering, you know that you expect that the theory is renormalizable in perturbation theory if the coupling constant is dimensionless. Okay. Yes?
Why should f mu nu have that dimension?
Because you want that, for instance, you want that the covariant derivative, you want it to be an object with a definite dimension. And the covariant derivative contains a derivative times an AMU. So AMU must have the same dimension of a derivative. Otherwise, this is not consistent. It will not be consistent with Lorentz invariance and everything. So it's not, it's a fact, in fact. It's not a requirement. It's a fact. So it's different from the scalar field, for instance, in the phi 4 theory, which has a dimension which depends on D. Here, gauge field must have a dimension minus 1 in terms of length. That's because it's a vector field. Okay. And you see then that if you do that, the ghost field, the ghost action, must have also the dimension of a length to the power minus 1. Okay. So, and from this you expect to have, it turns out it's true, the physicists have observed that you have in D equal 4, log lambda, ultraviolet divergences. If you want to compute one loop radiative correction. And that's particularly clear because you have the ordinary diagram of quantum electrodynamics plus some new one. So for instance, something that you have if you consider the two point irreducible function for the gluon for the gauge field, well, this is going to be the ordinary propagator, and then you are going to have let me not consider matter field. If you have matter fields, you are going to have a loop of fermions. But if you don't have a loop of fermions, you are going to have a diagram like that, plus a diagram like that, okay, which comes from this, the gluon interaction vertices. Well, they are of order g times g or g squared, so they are g squared. Well, they have a symmetry factor, which is 1/2 in both cases, but I won't. And then you have an additional diagram, which comes from the interaction between the ghosts and the gauge field. So you get a ghost loop, which is also over g squared,
Well, you have oriented ghost loops. So it's similar to a loop of fermions in quantum electrodynamics, except that the ghosts are bosons instead of spinors. Okay? And since they are fermions, you have a minus sign. Okay? And if you think about how this diagram behaves, you have an internal momenta that flows through the loop. You see? And for instance, this diagram, the propagator for the gluon field is in 1 over k squared plus this term. So you get a 1 over k squared here for this. You get a 1 over k squared for this. And the problem is that the gluon field, well, the gluon coupling may contain a k associated to one of the momenta. And if the k is associated to the momenta here or here, you see, you might have a k squared. You have integrator of d4k. But the k's must be there or there. So then you are going to have p. If this is a momenta, p, a p mu, p nu, and then something like 1 over k squared, k squared. You see what I mean? And you integrate over the internal momenta, which goes up to less than some lambda if you introduce a cutoff. So you have a potential lambda squared divergence here, which is not good, because it means that the radiative correction gives a mass to the gauge field. So it's incompatible with gauge invariance. And here you have a logarithmic divergence, d4k over k squared to the square. So you have a log lambda divergence with a p mu, p nu, and some structure, which is what you like, what you have in quantum electrodynamics. Okay. Well, the same here. It's similar here. And here it's similar. No, it's not similar because you have remember the propagator here, you only have this term on this because you have a propagator which is 1 over k squared, 1 over k squared, but you have a momenta coming from the loop. So this gives only a log lambda. So these two diagrams gives a log lambda squared divergence, and these diagrams, and I think not this diagram, because, no, yes, this diagram too. No, not this diagram. So this diagram and this diagram contains a log lambda. So it turns out that because of gauge invariance, this terms cancels. So it remains a divergence over the log lambda in the propagator of the gluon. Yes?
Could you just explain how you get that integral?
Pardon?
Could you explain where that integral comes from?
Well, it's simply that, consider this diagram. I just apply the rule of Fermat integration. So I have a mu A, mu, it's going to be A, but see. Here I have a gauge boson. I have a vertex. So let me not pay attention to the gauge in the indices because I've not written it explicitly. But here I have a momentum k that flows. Here I have a momentum k plus p. Here I have a momentum p that flows in, and here I have a momentum p that flows out. So the Feynman integral associated to this diagram is d4k, the integral of the four momenta. Here, this diagram is going to be a 1 over k squared. That's the propagator of the ghost. This
is going to be 1 over p squared plus k squared.
Ah, no, there is a, no, no, I'm sorry, there is a lambda squared. But here you have a momentum entering here.
And here there is a momentum. Sorry, I said something incorrect. So here you have a k mu. Here you have a pp plus k nu.
Yes, no, so I said something incorrect. So this is the Feynman amplitude that describes this diagram, plus color indices terms. And the color indices, in fact, there is a structure constant term at the piece F, A, B, C that occurs as usual because it's a commutator. So when you sum over the commutator, there is going to be an F, A, B, C, and then F, C, B, A. So you are going to have F, A, B, C, F, B, C, A. Well, let's call it A prime. And you sum over the B's here and the C's here. So you are going to have a delta A, A prime, which means that the indices color are controlled, and you have a number that comes from the structure of the group. So it's a group dependent factor. Okay. Is it clear? And now this, if you study this again at large k, you have d4k over some k squared divided by k squared plus k squared. So there is a potential lambda squared divergence term. And when you expand this in power of p, for instance, the standard trick is to write that 1 over p squared plus k squared. No, I'm sorry, that's p plus k squared. I'm very sorry. You write 1 over p plus k squared as 1 over k squared times, well, you expand 1 over k squared plus 2pk plus p squared. This is smaller with respect to this because k is large. So you can rewrite this as 1 over k squared minus 2pk divided by k squared plus some term which is going to have to contain some p squared times k to the, that's k to the 4, etc. And you combine everything, and you find that at the end, you are going to have a p nu log lambda coming from the subdominant term when k is large in this, in the integrand. Okay. So you have a log lambda. So this graph gives a dangerous lambda square term. Those two diagrams give also some dangerous lambda squared term. And the theory, the gauge theory is such that when you add this term, the Gauss contribution, the Gauss loop to the contribution from the interaction of the gauge field, they cancel. So the lambda squared mass term for the gauge field, so it would be an a mu lambda squared term, which is bad, which is, you don't want to this, cancels, disappear. Thanks to the ghosts. So you see at work, the mechanism that was built in the functional integral, which is that you have to introduce the Gauss in order to preserve gauge theories. And gauge theories forbids the gauge field to get a mass through radiative corrections. But it doesn't provide, it doesn't forbids the coupling constant G to get the radiative corrections. Okay, and so, well, in any good books like the Peschke-Schroeder, and I took some time to draw the diagram, but without calculating them in the lecture notes. But for instance, here we don't have a matter field, so we just have gluons. So in order to see what's happening for the renormalization of the coupling constant, G, you have to see how radiative corrections modify, for instance, this diagram. And this diagram, so the three-point function is going to be the initial tree level, which is over the G. And then you are going to have some radiative correction, which are going to be over the G cube, because they require three vertex. And you have this one. So you have a loop of gluons with three vertices added. You have also this one, because you may have a degree four vertex. Okay. And you have the possibility to have an internal loop of ghosts. Again, with a minus signs, because the ghosts are fermions. Yes?
Sorry, I have a question about the two-point function.
Yes.
So I can see that the lambda squared terms might cancel, but you still have that log lambda.
Yeah. I have this, I have this log lambda term. And this log lambda term, I should have said a word. This log lambda terms correspond to a renormalization of the field.
What does that
mean? It means simply that you must change a mu by a mu times some renormalization function. So you have to redefine the field.
So why, I mean, can you
see
why it renormalizes the field and not the mass?
Because renormalizing the field is compatible with gauge invariance. It's exactly like the renormalization of the wave function in QED. In QED, you have this diagram in QED. You have this diagram with a loop of fermions.
And?
Which induce a renormalization.
Of the field.
Exactly. So it's the same phenomenon, except that here the renormalization is induced by the loops of gauge field and loop of ghosts. Yes?
So if we had a lambda squared divergence that didn't cancel, could we get rid of that by renormalizing the field as well? Or is there a reason?
No, because this is a term which is proportional. It doesn't depend on P mu, P nu. It's a lambda squared delta mu nu.
Okay.
So if you have.
So it's because of the P.
Yeah.
P nu.
That's because it's. Because this is going to be a P mu. P nu. Log lambda. And the P nu log lambda will be taken care of with a counter term involving some d mu of, well, there are some other indices, but some d mu and a nu squared term. Yeah, because in fact, the log lambda depends on P mu, P nu, so it's going to have, yeah, it's a P mu, P nu, delta mu nu. So that's going to be given by that. So that's a term which is already in the action. It's a linear term. The Young-Bill section. Okay. And the same occurs in the same occurs in QED. So it's something which is not, you should not be surprised to. The QED term might have a lambda square term, but it's cancelled out by another mechanism. And you have a divergence which is P mu, P nu log lambda. Okay. Okay, so we have the renormalization. So you get those three diagrams. And again, if you think about it, well, it's going to be an integral d4k, where you have the momenta here. And here you may have some 1 over k squared to the power 3. And you might have some momenta here, k, k, k. You have plus term in p, k, k. If you have one of the coupling here outside and one inside, and so on. And here again, well, this is going to happen in our other diagrams too. And this would lead to a lambda divergence. Divergence which is, sorry, you don't see it. So this you have a potential linear divergence lambda. But the coefficient between the different diagrams cancels out. But it gives zero because of the ghost. And you have a log lambda divergence, which would be proportional to some of the p mu, some of the momenta carried over here by dimensional analysis. So it's taken by a counter term of the form a mu, a nu, well, a, da, with the indices mu, which is precisely of the form in the initial Lagrangian that gives this diagram. You see? So I'm very sketchy. You should do the calculation. But the dangerous linear terms here disappear. And you have a counter term, which turns out to be of the same form than the counter term in the action. So this should give a renormalization of G. Okay. Well, and so on. And the difficulty is that, of course, proving the renormalizability of the theory means that you have to perform the calculation for all the diagram and show that it's consistent. Because in the original action, the coupling for this vertex, the coupling for this vertex, and the coupling for this vertex are not independent. They are fixed by the group structure of the gauge series. So you have to check that when you compute the renormalization for the two-point function, the three-point function, you have a renormalization at one loop for the four-point function, and you have a renormalization for the ghost field and the ghost vertex. So you have three objects. You have the gauge propagator. You have the gauge three-point function. You have the gauge
four-point function. You have the ghost propagator, and you have the ghost gluon vertex. You have to check that they do not contain dangerous linear or quadratic divergence for the gauge invariance. And you have to check that the log divergence that all of them possess, you know, can be cancelled by counter terms which are consistent with the gauge symmetries of the original theory. So the counter terms cannot be independent. They must be the log lambda counter terms. Must be related by gauge symmetry. Okay, and they do. Well, so this is a very sketchy presentation. I wanted to. There are more details in the notes. There are more details in the standard books, like the book by Peskin and Schroeder. And the final result is that the gauge theory. Final result, the gauge theory. Is renormalizable. This has been a non-trivial result. So a bit of history, if you like. A bit of history is that, as far as I know, the fact that it's renormalizable has been proven at one loop first. In a famous paper by Toft and Veltman around 72, I think. And in order to do that and to prove gauge invariance, in fact, one of the simplification and the big achievement has been to use, instead of this cutoff regularization, which is not very well suited for gauge theories, to use dimensional regularization. Which consists in replacing the fact that you have momenta smaller than some cutoff by stating that you are in dimension D equal 4 minus epsilon, and then the ultraviolet singularity are poles in epsilon. The log lambda are replaced by log lambda. And the advantage of dimensional regularization is that it respects gauge invariance. It's explicitly gauge invariant. So if you use a dimensional regularization, you are ensured that at each step of your calculation, you are dealing with a theory which is gauge invariant in perturbation theory. Okay. Well, then, soon afterwards, I think there were general all-order proofs. For instance, I think there is in 74, I think there was an older proof by Lee. This is not T.D. Lee, but another Lee. And Jean Justin and some other. And something I might have time to say a word is that there has been a very elegant proof using the notion of BRST symmetry by Becky, Rue, Stora, and Sutin. But I might have gone to. Okay. So there is also another way to do the one loop calculation, which is one loop calculation, which is convenient to ensure that you have a gauge invariant while using this cutoff is quite difficult, is to use what's called the background
gauge fixing. And it's detailed, for instance, in the book by Peskin and Schroeder, in detail, because it ensures, it's a way also to ensure that you have some gauge, the gauge invariance. Okay. So before, if I have time, I will discuss a bit that. But of course, the important result outcome of this calculation is that since you have renormalization, if the theory can be renormalized by just so, the theory can just be renormalized by a renormalization of the gauge coupling constant. Plus a definition of the fields, as in QED. But the physics is contained in the renormalization of the charge. Okay. And so, the important result is that you can define a beta function which is defined in the usual way by seeing how the effective coupling constant runs with the subtraction scale, for instance. That's perfectly standard, so same defined in the same way as for the 5-4 theory. We introduce a normalization scale nu, and you see how the renormalized coupling constant vary when you change the renormalization scale. When the physics is fixed. So which different coupling constant defined with reference to an energy scale describes the same theory. Okay. So that's exactly the same difference. And in fact, from what have you seen here, in fact, you see that at one loop, you had a G squared term. So in fact, the effective coupling constant, the real coupling constant is alpha, which is G squared. Exactly like when in QED, the fine structure constant is alpha equal E squared in QED. But if alpha is G squared, you know, you can define a beta function for alpha, which is just obtained by taking the derivative with respect to alpha. So if you write mu dd mu alpha, you are of course going to be 2g times beta of g. So the beta function for alpha of alpha is 2g times the beta function for g. It's just a change of redefinition. Okay. And so the final result, the one loop beta function, which was first obtained by Toft and which was rederived quickly later by Gross, Mitzer, and who was the third one?
Wilczek?
Yeah, Wilczek. So Toft. Was that, well, for a group, let's say for a group G in general, the beta function for well, let me write it for alpha because that's more for alpha.
is alpha squared 1 over, what's the factor? So it's factor 2, 2 over 4 pi squared. This is a 4 pi squared that comes from integral over loops of momenta. And of course, then you have factors which come out from the from all the fermionic structure, the group structure. And the important point is that this is minus 11 over 3 times a number that depends on the group, which is called the Casimir. So C2 of G is the Casimir. It's a quadratic Casimir, which is simply defined by the fact when you take the products of two structure constants, DCD, CD, you find C2 of G times delta AB. And remember that when I discussed the divergence which appear in this diagram is precisely this products of two structure constant of group which appear. And in fact, they appear for the same reason in the other diagrams. So, and this a bit fancy minus 11 divided by 3 comes from the fact that you have a different factors and different symmetry factors for the contribution of the gauge field and the contribution of the ghosts. Okay. So for SU2, this C2 of G is 2. For SUN, for SU3, which is a group for quantum chromodynamics, C2 of G is N in general. So we are going to have a factor 3, etc. Okay. And so the important thing is, of course, the minus sign. Because it means that the beta function as a function of alpha is negative. And remember, it tells you how the effective coupling constant behaves with the energy. And so it means that the theory is asymptotically free. High energy. We discuss that when I discuss the meaning of a beta function for the 5-4 theory. Yes?
Is the quadratic Casimir always positive for all groups?
It's positive for, it's positive for compact group. It might be negative for non-compact group. But for a compact group, it's a simple, if you think a bit about what it means in terms of combining, it's somehow, it's proportional to the curvature of the group, if you want. The group, you know, a Lie group can be considered as a manifold. It has a natural structure, geometric structure on it. For instance, you know that basically SU2 is like the three-dimensional sphere. So this C2 of G is somehow related to the curvature of the group. I'm not sure if this is mathematically precise, but that's roughly speaking what's going on. So for instance, you know that for SU2 is something like the three-dimensional sphere, which is a curved space with negative positive curvature. But I think that that's a compact group. But for a non-compact group,
For instance, the group of symmetries of the hyperboloid, like SU11, etc., then I think the Casimir may be negative because the curvature, the space is negative. Not because I think SU. Okay. Okay, so the theory, the gauge theory, is assumed to be free. And this means that this has, of course, very important consequence. This is historically why gauge theories came back in the field of high energy physics, of experimental high energy physics, because they explained in the 70s the results of the experiment at SLAC, which are probing the nature of the hadrons, and finding they were inside hadrons weakly interacting particles, which are called partons. By the way, so this explains why gluons and partons in hadrons interacts weakly at high energy. So I think you are going to see this in the advanced course in high energy physics, but I'm not a high energy physicist, so I can speak about that, but I'm not the best person. But so it's important, it has been important since the 70s. For high energy physics. Okay. It's also very important for the consistency of your mid theory. It's related to this because it means that the effective coupling constant at high energy is small. And we can integrate that because you can think about this by stating that replace this equation by the fact that alpha of E, the effective coupling constant with the energy, scales like E g alpha divided by E. Equals a beta function, so basically it's a minus some positive coefficient, minus some B2 coefficient, times alpha squared. With B2, it's a one-loop term of the beta function, so it's positive. So integrating this is trivial. If you go to higher order, that's less, but then you find that alpha of E is alpha 0, let's say, divided by 1, plus B2 alpha 0 log E, where alpha 0 is alpha where E equal the choice of unity. You start from alpha 0 at some energy scale and you see. So you see that when E becomes large, this behaves like 1 over log E. Goes to zero. Okay. Yes?
If I remember correctly, the electromagnetic coupling increases energy?
Yeah, so that's different. So Young mills are very different from QED or phi to the 4.
But why?
Yeah, why?
But why is it different from
QED? It's different because the coefficient of the beta function is different. So it's a result of a calculation. Well, there are some physical, you know, on-waving explanation of that. I can come back in 5 minutes.
So this formula is only for Young mills.
It's for any gauge theory. Yeah, it's for gauge theories, not abelian gauge theory. You see, for QED, the gauge group is U1, And U1 has no structure constant, so C of U1 is zero. So the beta function for QED is zero. Well, for Maxwell theory is zero, but then you have to add the contribution of the fermions. And the contribution of the fermions is positive. So for QED, the renormalization of the Kuplik constant comes from this diagram. It comes from, wait a minute, yeah, it comes from this diagram. From those diagrams. So if you had no fermion, this would not exist and this would not exist. And that Maxwell is free theory. Yes?
So what's the difference between QED and just a U1 Yang Mills?
And
U1 Yang Mills.
U1 Yang Mills has no fermion.
Okay, so it's the fermion that basically turns the beta function.
Yeah. And in fact, I didn't wrote it, but you can find it in the notes, but also in any books, in the books by me. If you take into account the matter field, then you get a contribution of the matter field, which is positive, because they come, it comes from basically the same diagram, with a bit of dressing by, but I think it's basically just those diagrams, because, well, you have an additional diagram. In Young-Mills, you have also this diagram, which is going to change a little bit the contribution. Okay. And the contribution for matter field is some other coefficient, which is C of R, where this is a Casimir, this is an object that depends on the representation. I'm sorry, you probably cannot see. So basically what you have to remember is you have a positive contribution from matter fields. So if you take a Young-Mills theory and add enough fermions, the theory will become again non-asymptotically free. So this is gate field as a contribution of the matter field. Okay. Yes?
So say for QCD. You have matter fields in the form of quarks, like fermions for
yes.
There as well, right?
Yes.
But it's still asymptotically free.
Yeah, so it's still true. For QCD, which is SU3 plus quarks. And you have three families of quarks, but that's not enough to make the theory asymptotically, not non-asymptotically free. And that's true also for the standard model, Weinberg-Salam model, which is based on an SU2 cross U1 up to the Higgs field, which makes things not completely asymptotically free. But still, nature seems to like asymptotically free theory. And I'm going to explain to you why. So first, you see that this goes to zero. And here now, I think I can answer to a question that one of you, maybe it was you, asked me last week, which says that in perturbation theory, we assume that the coupling constant is small, but when doing renormalization theory, we manipulate infinite constant in the coupling constant. So this seems inconsistent. This is consistent. So the renormalization program is consistent for Young-Mills, precisely because the effective coupling constant The higher energy is, the smallest it is. So in some word, if you want to, you introduce a regulator. So you assume that the energy is always smaller than some lambda. And then it means that at energy scale lambda, the coupling constant, the bare coupling constant you have, if you want, in your functional integral, has to be of the order alpha of lambda, which is of order 1 over log lambda. So it's indeed small. So the higher you work in energy, the more you can trust perturbation theory. And therefore, the continuum limit, the limit lambda goes to infinity, can be controlled. It's under control in a mathematical way. And that's different from QED or Phi-4, where the continuum limit, you have control on it only in perturbation theory, but not in a non-perturbative way. And in fact, mathematical physicists, so physicists, have been able to provide a proof, a rigorous proof in the sense of mathematics, that Young-Mills theory exists in the continuum limit. That's a series of very complicated papers. I can give you the reference. Unfortunately, of course, with mathematics, you have always some price to pay. They are able to prove that Young-Mills theory exists in the ultraviolet in a very, very tiny box. A box which is much smaller than the size of any hadrons, for instance. Well, they showed it for pure Young-Mills, but for pure Young-Mills, you have bound states, which are called glue balls, which have some energy, so they have some size. And they are not able to show that, to prove that they are glue balls or that. But they are able to prove that if you define a Young-Mills theory in a very, very tiny box, then it makes sense mathematically. But that's already a non-trivial result. And of course, this problem arises because the price to pay when you have a theory which is asymptotically free in the infrared, it is that it is not asymptotically free in the ultraviolet. It's not asymptotically free at low energy. And you see that here you have a problem. When you have a denominator here, so when the energy is of the order exponential of minus 1 over B2 alpha, 0, where alpha 0 is a coupling constant at scale 1. Because then perturbation theory breaks down. Perturbation theory breaks down. Okay. Well, it doesn't imply that the theory doesn't make sense in the big box. If you can define a quantum theory in a small box, then you can glue small box and you get something which exists also mathematically. But it means that you cannot compute what's going on in a big box by perturbation theory. So the physics becomes non-perturbative. Okay. And it's known that in Young-Mills theory, this exists. First, this formula means that you have an energy scale. So if you want, you can write this as a mass scale. It's an energy, so it's a mass. So you have a mass scale over the exponential of minus 1 over B2, the coupling constant, where non-perturbative theory, well, the physics become non-perturbative. So this phenomenon is called dynamical generation of a mass. And you see, you can never see the appearance of this mass scale in perturbation theory, because if you try to make a Taylor expansion of exponential minus 1 over alpha 0, this is, when alpha 0 is 0, this is exponential of minus infinity, so it's 0. But it's alpha 0 times 0 plus alpha 0 squared times 0 plus etc. So it's a function of alpha 0 whose Taylor expansion is 0 at all orders. It's a function. Function of alpha 0. It's a function which is non-zero. I write this mass E here. But it's infinity flat. So it's a well-known example in mathematics of function which is which is non-zero, but which has no Taylor expansion. Okay. So now, as you know, as all of you know already, the main non-perturbative phenomena which is expected from Young-Mills theory and which is observed is the phenomenon of a confinement. It is that the interaction becomes so strong at long distance that, for instance, well, the initial theory in the hadron is made of gluons and quarks, which are fermions. So the gluons are the photon for the Young-Mills, and the quarks are the electron and positron that's a photon, if you want. Okay, and that's the Dirac field. Okay, and they interact weakly in a hadron at small energy. But when you try to separate them, if you try to extract a gluon or to extract a quark, nobody has seen a gluon, an isolated gluon or an isolated quark, while you observe in everyday life, at least in anything, photons and electrons or positrons. So, this phenomenon is called confinement. It's expected that the interactions are so strong at large distance that it costs an infinite energy to extract a gluon or a quark from an environment. So only states which are sorts of color singlets can exist asymptotic states in the state of a quantum theory. States that can exist independently and can make scattering experiments out of them. Okay. So for pure Young-Mills, where you have no quarks, it is believed and it's observed in some numerical simulations that you can have only bound states of gluons, which are color singlets, and which are called blue balls. Okay. In, for instance, QCD, where you have quarks and gluons, the only color singlets are objects with two quarks, they are mesons, objects with three quarks, which are hadrons, and then there are some speculation, for instance, and I think it's still experimentally debated whether they have tetraquarks or pentaquarks. But this is still experimentally very much debated theoretically because they are not really stable. They tend to break up. While you know that hadrons, well, at least some hadrons, hadrons are stable if you don't take into account the electroweak interactions. Of course, the neutron is unstable, but that's because of the electroweak interaction. And mesons also. Yes. Okay. And then this object has have an energy. They have a mass. Have a mass, which comes from the binding energy coming from the interaction of those elementary particles. And the mass is precisely of the order of this non-perturbative mass scale generated, which is, well, there is going to be of the order exponential minus 1 over E2 alpha squared, alpha. And if you ask why this is a number and why this is a mass, because in fact, of course, alpha zero is the looping at renormalization scale mu. So in fact, this has to be the number times the renormalization scale. And if you apply this equation and define for different mu, different of alpha, the mass of the state of the theory should not change. So this is, of course, this is independent on the way you compute. It's a physical, the physical mass scale of the theory. Okay.
Does it,
yes?
Correspond to some physical mass?
Pardon?
Does it, you say it's a mass scale of the theory.
Yes.
Does it correspond to any physical mass of some?
Yes, of course. So by those, you can take that the mass of the proton is a physical scale of QCD. Mm-hmm. Well, QCD is more complicated because in QCD you have massless gluons, but you have massive quarks, and the quarks have masses parameter that people are trying to understand understand the origin of masses of the leptons, so of the quarks and of the leptons in some grand unified theory, and there are mechanisms, the study mechanism like the seesaw mechanism to explain why some leptons have big mass and some leptons have very small mass, for instance. So there is a Weinberg-Salam model physics that comes out. But imagine that you had an ideal QCD with just gluons and massless quarks. Then you would still have a proton with different property, which would be massive. And you could take the mass of this bound state, of this state of the theory, of this particle state, as the elementary, the unit of mass of the theory. Mm-hmm. So it's generated dynamically by the quantum physics, the interaction between the quantum fields. But once you know it, you know all the physics. If you know the mass of one of the hadron, you are in principle able to compute the masses of all the other ones, of the blue balls, etc., and all the spectrum of theory out of this. Okay. Yes?
You have that mass scale even if where physics is not perturbative anymore, even without mass fields, matter fields, right?
Yes.
Just with gauge fields. So,
yes.
At that scale, would the theory produce a mass term that breaks gauge symmetry?
No. Gauge symmetry is always restored. Gauge symmetry is always a gauge theory.
So then, what's the meaning of that mass scale when you don't have matter fields?
You have bound state of the gluons. And these bound states are massive because they have a rest binding energy coming from the interaction between the gluon. So all their energy comes from the interactions between them. And none of the energy, none of the mass comes from mass of the gluons at high energy because they have no mass because of gauge invariance. All the mass comes from the interaction energy.
Okay. And that's like the gluon ball. It's not a term that it's present in the action, just like that.
No, no, it's not a fundamental field. Mm-hmm. This is a very composite object. So you can only, you expect only to observe composite objects in the theory. The fields are there at high energy, but you cannot observe them directly. You can observe them only indirectly. But you can observe them indirectly. Mm-hmm. Yes?
So as you renormalize, you will never see a mass term appear.
You will never have a mass term for the gauge field appearing. Because otherwise, you would be able to observe a gluon. Because then it could escape and stay there. You know, a field which has a mass, its excited set are particles which have a finite mass, so they have a mass at rest. So they would be easy to spot.
And also you're assuming that the classical symmetry, gauge symmetry, is still valid in the quantum level.
Yes, yes, yes.
So if you allow quantum anomalies, then you could have the production of mass terms.
Yes. Of course, if you have anomalies, that's another thing. But here you are speaking about anomaly, gauge anomalies. And I think gauge anomalies are not that easy to produce. Well, there is a whole theory. But if you have a gauge anomaly, it means that the gauge theory doesn't make sense in itself. To have an anomaly of a classical symmetry, a rigid symmetry, do happen in nature. For instance, there is this famous axial anomaly that explains a lot of properties of the pion, etc., which is but it's a global symmetry. Scale anomaly is a global symmetry. Usually gauge anomalies are consistency, gives consistency condition on ground unified theory, because you don't want a theory which is gauge anomalies at how energy. Remember that gauge symmetries are in some sense not physical symmetry in the sense that they are redundancy in the description of the physics by vector fields. So they are very important, they are at the core of modern physics, but they are consistency condition of construction of a theory with vector fields. Well, I think I will stop there because otherwise, if I start to discuss something else, like, for instance, you know, how we define the string tension, which is related to the confinement, it's going to take us too long. But. So, tomorrow, I'm going to explain how all of this can be escaped by constructing gauge theories with massive vector field, which is the famous Higgs mechanism. And so I give a very short introduction of that. In the case of the abelian U1 Higgs mechanism, so based on the Maxwell theory. But I'm going to also discuss its connection with plasma waves and
condensed matter physics. Maybe you have seen that already in the condensed matter course if you had an introduction to the theory of supraconductivity. But this has been this is both important conceptually and has been important in the history of how the Higgs mechanism was discovered and implemented by high energy physicists. In fact, some of the basic idea behind this mechanism come from classical or non-relativistic physics. And I'm going to explain that to give you a good overview of what is really the Higgs mechanism.